Hey, Coach, Chris Oliver here. I did a basketball knowledge brain dump podcast, episode 349, and the feedback was really good. And it was just an opportunity for me to be able to share a whole bunch of ideas that have just been going through my mind. And since that time, obviously, we've gone through an end of season for many coaches and many clients I work with, and then into the off season. And then my travels have literally taken me to different places around the world. Australia, Lithuania, throughout obviously America, into Canada. So just wanted to connect with a whole bunch of ideas that have come up through conversations with everything from NBA players on down to new learners in terms of coaches and players and all the different things that I hope can add value to your coaching. And we'll go from here.
Hey, coach, a brief time out from the podcast to bring you the Analytics Minute sponsored by Hoopsalytics. How do you decide who your biggest impact players are? Traditional stats don't tell the whole story, which is why high-level pro and college teams rely on analytics systems like Hoopsalytics to make data-driven lineup decisions. Examining team stats when a player is on the floor tells a more compelling story. For example, you can use net points per possession to determine your best two-way players, as well as your offensive and defensive stars, or use the team rebounding percentage for each player to see who has the biggest impact on rebounding. The results may surprise you. Hoopsalytics brings the most powerful analytics to teams of all levels. It's easy to use and affordable. It's like AI for basketball coaches. Discover how Hoopsalytics can help you make better data-driven coaching decisions. Visit hoopsalytics.com/ball. That's HOOP. SALYTICS.com/ball today to learn more and start analyzing your games for free.
One of the analogies that came up, Naval, one of the great thought sharers, I feel, through his podcast and different types of ways that he shares. But he said basically something. Imagine teaching a child to ride a bike. You could give them a detailed manual, supervised fine-tuning, but they'll likely learn better by trying it themselves, reinforcement learning, falling, getting up, and gradually improving. And when I read that, I'm always trying to find different ways to be able to connect this information for you as a coach. And for your players and for your parents as well, to be able to shape how we approach teaching, now, particularly within the basketball immersion framework, and now within the NBA and the different framework that I'm sharing within there to coaches. And this bike analogy really resonated for me because I remember vividly trying to get my daughters, particularly my oldest, because she was the first, to learn how to ride a bike. And it went against my instincts, certainly because safety is always first. Safety is always first. So that supersedes everything. Throwing people in the deep end is fine, but the number one concern is always safety. So when first she's tried to ride a bike, it connected for me that I could tell her a whole bunch of things, or I could just put her on the bike and see if she can ride the bike. And that may seem unsafe. Certainly, I was beside her, and certainly, I was there. And certainly, there were a lot of falls and a lot of challenges. But to me, the best way for her to learn how to ride a bike was to figure it out. And she actually learned very fast because I think part of it was that I removed any type of technique-based thinking. And essentially, again, she could watch videos. She's seen people ride the bike. She stared at people riding a bike. She has a very good feel and understanding of how to ride a bike. So it was just a question of putting herself in the situation and then falling, getting up, and gradually improving. And I feel like the process was very fast, in part because, again, I removed technique. If she asked a question, or sometimes I asked a question, and then that was different ways to be able to direct thinking. Hey, if you lean this way, what happens? If you do this, what happens? If you stop pedaling, what happens? Just different types of questions to be able to guide learning. For me, again, this connects back, and you'll hear this kind of throughout this episode, where I'm going to talk a little bit about this bike analogy and this idea of how we teach players and why we teach players in a certain way versus another way. And at the Nike EYBL Coaches Clinic, I had an opportunity to introduce Missouri's head coach, Dennis Gates. I've worked with their program extensively for multiple years in terms of shaping how they practice, how they play, style of play, and everything like that. I'm so grateful for Coach Gates and his coaching staff, which have been such a positive reflection of kind of this modern approach, for lack of a better term. And it was awesome to have Coach Gates in front of all these coaches, sharing the constraints-led approach that he approaches practice with, practice design, and I'll share more of the takeaways with that. But Where I started my introduction was to give coaches a little bit of a perspective on where I'm coming from and why I'm here. And the main thing for me was that my journey started 30 years ago when I was a very young assistant coach with a program and a player who was one of our best players on the team and one of the best players in the country at the time came up to me. It was just a random fall practice. And he came up to me and he said, "Are we going to play any basketball in practice today?" Of course, being a young assistant, being loyal at the time, I said, "Yes, of course we are." And not thinking any deeper about it in that moment, but after the fact, reflecting on that very question and thinking, wow, were we going to play basketball again in practice today? And what that meant to a player. What did playing basketball mean in practice? Playing basketball in practice mean for a player? For me, that was a very powerful question that really has brought me to this point where I'm sharing all these ideas. Some might consider them divergent. I consider them just reflecting on, is there a better way? So much has changed in the world, as we've said many times, and why would the way we teach and coach not have changed in the last 30 years? So that very foundational question is what I led into the EYBL Coaches Clinic to be able to help coaches frame an understanding of why I'm in front of them, being somewhat divergent from maybe the way that they were coached or the way that they coach, and challenging them to think just constantly, is there a better way? Taking that a step further, what does that mean? Here's a basic understanding of this concept of playing more basketball in practice. Take a traditional drill, three-man weave. And Coach Cage very directly looked at all the coaches and said, "Stop doing three-man weave." And his rationale was that the one that I've been sharing, and many coaches have come to the same conclusion, is three-man weave is fluff. There's no decisions. It basically creates a situation of mindless practice where players follow a pattern that they've memorized, and there's no solutions within this drill. Because the drill itself is rote learning, meaning it's memorize, regurgitate, do it over and over again. And by and large, that does not transfer any perceptual information, any decision-making information, and particularly does not transfer any techniques that apply in a representative, ever-changing environment in basketball. So I'm not here necessarily to disparage three-man weave, but to be honest, your challenge is if you do it, consider removing it. Because it's really fluff that takes away from learning time. And there's many drills like that. But the alternative, because again, I'm a solution-based thinker. I'm not here to just tell you something's wrong and throw it out. The solution to me has always been something that foundationally I've shared since the beginning of basketball immersion in 2014, and this concept of three-on-one transition. And essentially all it was born from is this idea of adding a defender to three-man weave. And I will say initially, before I came to this three-on-one through various influences and adopted and adapted ideas from other coaches, but obviously just messing around with it, the first thing I did is literally just added a defender to three-man weave. You have to follow this pattern down the floor, and there's a defender that's actively trying to stop you from scoring, and you're trying to score, but the constraint, you must follow this three-man weave pattern. And you can imagine how difficult that was for players. They had to follow this three-man weave pattern that we have taught them and we have instructed them to do over and over again as a part of this concept of perfect practice, doing these beautiful reps that look so good. And as soon as I added a defender to three-man weave, what do you think happened? Of course, players struggled, players couldn't score, players couldn't complete the pattern because the defender was now causing disruption. And you might say to yourself, of course, if there's a defender, then you wouldn't run the three-man weave pattern. Hopefully, this connects to you. Then, why are you doing the drill? Why are you doing a drill that doesn't help a player individually improve and help your team succeed? And to me, if you just add a defender to a lot of your traditional drills that you do on air, memorize patterns, isolated, and you add a defender and say the defender's live, the drill is no longer the drill you think it is. And the drill no longer affords them any opportunity to transfer solutions from practice to game. And there's a simple exercise. If you want to go through, this is a great time of year. A lot of you in your off season, you're coming up with your master drill list, your master plan for the season. Just go through every one of those drills that you traditionally use and say, if I added a defender, if I added one more defender, would they be able to follow this pattern? And this obviously only applies to those type of drills that are rote learning, memorization, isolated practice, those different things, technique-based practice, etc. And I'll connect this a little bit later too. But if I think about that in the context of a lot of dribble moves, man, wow. If there's one thing that I feel like trainers around the world do such a good job of, that is teaching on-air dribble moves. I have seen stuff literally in different places, in different gyms, with different levels of coaches. I've seen so many creative dribble on-air moves that people are teaching. But again, if you teach them this and you prescribe this and they do this and they do this, say, blocked rep over and over again of this move, then I challenge you to say, what happens when you add a defender? Are they doing the move exactly the way that you've taught them the move? Of course not. Now, they may be components of the move. There may be certain characteristics of the move. But by and large, the player then has to figure out a solution based on not the move that you memorized, not the move that you taught them, but based on the defender and the environment. And that's why skill, technique, let's talk specifically about technique. Technique is obviously very important. Sure, it matters. But modern coaching skill acquisition definitely does not say technique doesn't matter, but it does say that it is individual and molded by context. Think isolated technique work. Does that seamlessly transfer to the game? Of course it doesn't. And that example right there is a great example of three-man weave, add a defender, it doesn't transfer. It doesn't transfer to the game at all. And then add a defender to the dribble move that you've just had them regurgitate 10, 20 straight times over practices on air versus a pylon or a cone. And then, of course, it doesn't transfer because now the player has to come up with a solution within this ever-changing environment based on a defender. And then obviously the complexity increases when we add more defenders and we add more offensive players and there's less space. So exploration of techniques, yes, absolutely is key. So rather than doing this isolated dribble, and again, I'll come back to this a little bit later, this isolated dribble move, I'm just going to give them the constraint of here's the task. You have space, the defender is approaching you and closing that space, and now we're going to play live out of that with different constraints. Can't take two dribbles in a direction not towards the rim is one of the constraints that I use a lot for one-on-one. So we're not prescribing a dribble limit because a dribble limit leads to players picking up the ball without a decision. We're talking about a direction limit. You can't take two dribbles not towards the rim. And that's a simple idea of you can't do a banana to be able to beat a player in one-on-one because you can't do this half banana cut because in a game, there's a help side defender there. So being able to play in straight lines, being able to create space, different things like that. So the exploration of that is more important than the prescription of a move. And again, just reflect on all the drills that you do. If you added a defender to this on-air drill, would they still be able to do the drill? And by and large, no, because these are memorized patterns. These aren't things that actually happen that way in a game because of your teammates and because of the defense. So think about that riding the bike example. I spend all this time, say, getting my daughters to pedal on a stationary bike, doing different blocked repetitions. So let's pedal 10 times fast, followed by maybe 4 times slow, followed by 10 times fast again. Or I apply different constraints. You have to pedal by leaning to your left. You have to pedal by leaning to your right. And again, all this sounds great, and all these are great technique repetitions of being on a bike. But the problem is on the stationary bike, which is akin a lot to the examples that a lot of you give me, is they need this isolated technique practice. Great, they need this isolated technique practice. If you feel that, that's cool. But they don't need it the way that you think you need it. And again, reflect on this bike example. All those reps on a stationary bike, if I did all those reps with my daughter, leaning to the left, leaning to the right, sure, there's components of it that may transfer, but very little of it actually transfers in terms of helping her actually figure out how to ride a bike. Because again, the bike and the movement of the bike, the movement of the bike over different surfaces, the movement of the bike, obviously, in different weather conditions, the movement of the bike relative to going fast, going slow, uphill, downhill, etc. None of that can be simulated in the isolated bicycle practice on a stationary bike. We can talk about it. We can explain that it's potentially there. Sometimes you have to speed up. Sometimes you have to slow down. Sometimes you have to raise your butt off the seat. Sometimes you have to go down. Sometimes you have to lean right. Sometimes you have to lean right. You get it. You get it. Sure, I can talk about it and they can get a general feel for it. But to me, that doesn't help them learn how to ride a bike in the context that we want them to ride a bike, which is in this ever-changing environment with different factors that we can't account for. And that's the same that we coach. We coach in these isolated environments by and large, where then we think, okay, now go do that technique in the game. But the game environment is totally different. The game environment is completely different. So think about that, reflecting on if I added a defender to my isolated drills and am I training a player on a stationary bike and then expecting them to be able to bike in the real world to school and back? Like it's a different context completely. So we talk about players not knowing how to play the game, but then we put them in drills like three-man weave where all they have to do is memorize the answer. So no question, of course they're going to struggle. They're going to struggle in the game because what we did in the practice didn't actually help them. So again, coming back to that difference between three-man weave and three-on-one transition, I had a chance to do this with some very high-level players, some future NBA and WNBA draft picks. Three-on-one transition. Obviously, I didn't do the three-man. We went right into three-on-one transition. First of all, I encourage you all to consider doing this. I've given you the three E's before. I'll just remind you real quickly: environment, exploration, explicit instruction. So this is the methodology that I now share around the world with coaches about what I do and how I coach within a practice. This is guidance for me in terms of how I run a drill. This is guidance for me for how I run a practice. First, I want to create the environment. So the drill, three-on-one transition, I want to create an environment for learning. The second part is I want them to explore the drill with as little information from me as possible. And then thirdly, I can use explicit teaching, explicit instruction to be able to help them understand how they can do better. And that's what coaching is. I'm trying to get them to understand how can you do better. So with these high-level players that I just did three-on-one transition with, it is the same as when I do it with 11-year-olds. It's the exact same thing when I do it anywhere around the world. Players initially over dribble the ball, over pass the ball, and don't play the game with the mindset of the goals to score. The goals to score as effectively and as efficiently as possible. They play the game in the context of an isolated drill. They really do. They play the game with this, oh, we've done these passing drills, so we've got to pass it back and forth. We've done these organized three-on-one or three-on-two, two-on-one drills, so we've got to execute this. No. And then gradually what the value of this drill is for me is it actually defundamentalizes players. It gets them to think deeper in the context of the game. And three-on-one transition, there's multiple videos free available on YouTube, Basketball Immersion YouTube, three-on-one transition if you look it up. But this to me is a platform drill. This is a drill that I do every day from a player development standpoint and a team development standpoint because it connects to the whole point of what we're trying to do. Principles of play, space. We're trying to play in space. Advantage. If you have an advantage, take advantage of advantage. Remember, space relative to a defender is an advantage. So if we hit ahead, so we get the ball, we hit ahead in three-on-one transition. And it's a one-on-one in the open court, and the offensive player has space, that is an advantage. Now, a bigger advantage is the defender is not, say, chest to chest in that space, that the defender still has to recover from an angle. So we have an angle advantage and we have a speed space for speed advantage. But the example still holds is that there's an advantage. So in any three-on-one situation that we're playing within this drill, it is always one-on-one before it is two-on-one. And it should never be three on one. And if the third player really ever gets involved, then I've got to find a way to be able to shape that learning and understand that is actually taking away our advantage because clearly we wouldn't have that much time in a game. So we're trying to score as efficiently as possible, as effectively as possible, with as few dribbles as possible, and with as few passes as possible. And that tends to blow people's minds a little bit, especially young people. So when I'm teaching this and when I just taught this to high-level players, that was the hardest thing for them, that they didn't understand that, okay, even though they had this incredible technique, the technique was incredible. Like, I was blown away actually by the level of these players from a technique standpoint. But what they didn't understand is the whole point of their technique. Why do I have this great technique? We have this technique so that you can score as effectively as possible, as efficiently as possible, and three-on-one really highlights that for them. And we highlighted in the sense that skill is the elimination of something. You maybe heard me say this before. Skill is not just the addition. It's not just adding new things. And there's just trainers out there that really value this stuff. Then think about that. How can you help a parent and a player understand that they've got better because they actually are not doing this as much? They aren't dribbling as much. They aren't passing as much. They are actually making decisions in the context of the game. And we all say 0.5 or I say 0 seconds, but within that context. And again, a lot of things that we teach in isolated training basically teach players to be able to be to add more rather than eliminate things from their game. So in 3-on-1 transition, and again, this may seem like a deep dive, but I think it highlights the points, is 3-on-1 transition is, let's say there's one pass away, I catch it in space in the race to read area where I have it on tight to the sideline. I run hard to the sideline. I look back when I get to half court. I get the pass there. And now I have space for speed to be able to attack that defender. I attack that defender in that space, nose to nose, as direct as line as possible. And then I'm not trying to make a dribble move. That's the whole thing about teaching all these dribble moves. I'm literally, as a player, at a disadvantage if I have to make a dribble move. My best move in basketball is a straight line drive attack, where I drive through someone, not around someone, and then I take advantage of space or angles, shoulder to chest, and I drive in a straight line. I only change direction if that defender takes away, say, my first dribble, not towards the rim, and then I counter. But too many players are approaching players in space and making a dribble move where they already have an advantage, which is space for speed. Space is an advantage. We don't have to teach a move in space. We have to teach them how to attack a defender in a straight line. And again, this comes back to a lot of things that we're teaching. I get it. It's a business. We've got to have sizzle. We've got to have sexy. We've got to be able to sell players. Hey, you do this move. But the reality is, so many players would be better served by just having you play a lot of one-on-one with them, a lot of different types of advantage, small-sided games where they have to utilize their space. Let's say it's a dynamic start and they have no space to start with, defender's arm length away, no space. And now we challenge that offensive player, okay, where can you create space? And they would, every player in the world can answer this, sideways and backwards. So you can start with a sideways dribble or backwards dribble. And then from there, you're reading the advantage. If I move sideways with my dribble, we call it a skate dribble, you skate to the side. If the defender moves with you, but your ball and your shoulder are outside of them, so you have a shoulder to chest advantage, then what would you do? And obviously the answer is I would attack, I would drive through them. I would be confrontational with my drive. If I move sideways with the dribble and the defender moves chest to chest or moves too far to be able to cut me off, then all I need to do is counter and go and drive through them. And that to me is the simplicity of offense. Now, same scenario, I start with space for speed as I gave you in the beginning. I have the ball, I catch it on the wing in the 3-on-1 transition, and now I'm driving at a defender that's back in recovery. Then I want to take away that offensive player or that defensive player's space by driving a straight line at them, nose to nose. Now, that's assuming they position themselves between ball and basket, which most defenders would, but I want to go at them straight line. The first thing is I want to keep it in the same hand and be able to drive to score by keeping the ball in the same hand. The second thing would be is if the defender makes an early shift to be able to cut off my space, then I can counter. And then I can counter and be able to change direction and be able to attack and drive through them the opposite way. So 3-on-1 transition particularly develops that mindset of connecting that one-on-one work that I'm talking about, where we play a lot of one-on-one with a space advantage and with no space advantage. And then we're connecting it to the game in these situations. And it comes back to foundationally what I challenge you all to try and do and think about. You teach something, you connect something, transfer something. So I teach something, space for speed. What do we do when you have space for speed? We want you to be able to drive to score. And if you can't score, then you get into secondary decisions. So we're attacking closeout or attacking a player in space and transition, as that 3-on-1 example goes. Then I want to be able to attack to score. If I don't have those possibilities, what are secondary possibilities, whether they're protection plans or counters, and be able to play out of those things. So I want them to be able to explore these possibilities without giving them explicit instruction, explicit technique. So I encourage you with these examples to teach instead of moves. And again, I'm not anti-moves. I'm just saying what actually helps a player get better. And you think about that example of teaching them all the moves and then add a defender. What do they do? Do we help them select move 7 in the series that you taught them, or do they have to figure it out in the fly? So instead, teach players how to exploit space, how to take advantage of an angle to attack shoulder to chest, and then how to put a defender off balance. And space for speed, driving at someone full speed is one of those examples. And sure, there are a place for some dribble moves occasionally, but very few players honestly ever use dribble moves. And if you watch the game, you know that. So one of the things that we're foundationally teaching players probably 100% of time in individual workouts, they don't actually use in game situations. And that's multiple dribble moves. So if you teach them, if you put them in a situation, if you put them in a situation where they're playing one-on-one, guided or live, versus you or versus another player, and you start with space, or you start with no space, or you start with giving them an angle, whether it's a good angle or a bad angle, or you start with a defender on balance or off balance, there are affordances everywhere. And that is the foundation of a constraint-led approach, is that I want to afford a player an opportunity to be able to explore possibilities within the context of the game, how to apply different techniques as solutions. But again, the technique is directly connected to the environment in which I put them in. The player searches, decides, and executes based on their reading the space and reading the advantage or the angle. So, skill to me, which is a combination of both technique and decision making, skill is about recognizing that they have the tools to take advantage of advantage or to exploit an advantage, or to get out of trouble when they don't have an advantage, or to create an advantage out of neutral. So to me, that's what skill is. Skill is recognizing that. So if we don't have those situations represented in our on-air, in our on-air practice or our memorized drills, then players aren't going to recognize them as fast. Sure, can players still get there? For sure they can, because players have a lot of different ways beyond our practices to be able to improve.
Hey, coach, a brief interruption of our podcast. You know the best player development is coaching development. So let's work together to get your entire basketball organization or program unparalleled expertise and access to Basketball Immersion's group memberships. It's affordable and your players will thank you. Contact us today, basketballimmersion.com contact page, or DM us on X or Instagram. Get your coaches full access to our extensive coaching video library, detailed courses, and modern evidence-based coaching ideas. You can have proven coach development at your fingertips for all of your coaches. Elevate your coaches, elevate your teams, get started now. Basketball Immersion Group membership is where innovation meets excellence. Contact us today at basketballimmersion.com contact page, or DM us on X or Instagram. Now back to the podcast.
I'm saying if we want to accelerate learning, then there is a better way. And that is always connecting everything that you do, whether it's technique or tactics, to the context of the game. Give you another example, play a lot of one-on-one. So three pass one-on-one. We use three passes only because we feel it better represents the distance and recovery of a defender on a closeout. So let's say they start from some angle. And by the way, we want to constantly change the angles of approach of the defender. That's good for the defense, but it also changes the advantage for the offense, so that if we don't always start this three pass sequence from the defender right under the rim. The defender passes from right under the rim, a pass back from the offensive player, and then the third pass triggers live. That's what we call three pass one-on-one. But we don't just always play from there. We'll play from a side angle. We'll play from a quarter angle. We'll move the offensive player clearly, but we want to always play in different contexts. And you think about manipulating constraints, it's literally just as simple as that. It's like manipulating the angle in which this three pass one-on-one gets triggered, manipulating where the offensive player stands. Like, they always stand facing the rim with perfect feet. That's not how it happens. So we could have them moving to the ball. We could have them not facing the ball. We could have them with wide feet. We could have them with narrow feet. We could have them on one foot. Just different things that kind of change the ecological understanding for the player of what the environment is going to afford them in terms of a solution or a possible solution. So different things. So this three pass one-on-one is kind of a found, again, another platform drill that we do a lot. So many examples of it on basketball immersion. There's an example of another one-on-one called bounce closeouts that's on our YouTube channel. A very similar concept, which the bounce affords the defender an opportunity to be able to get closer than just say a pass, one pass. Anyways, different examples. So the reason I'm bringing up one-on-one is because I want to give you some different examples of constraints because I've just actively done this. I did this in Lithuania at the NBA basketball school. I did this at Court of Leaders with some of the NBA players, future NBA players, I should say. But the possibility here is that now we play one-on-one and we play, say, 3-on-3, or we play these different games. And all I do is manipulate the constraint. Here's an example. Now, first player who catches the ball must attack off the dribble. First player that catches the ball must pass. So there must be one pass. In the one-on-ones, obviously you must attack, so you can't shoot to start with, but then I gradually introduce different constraints. So you must attack and counter. So when you drive, you must change directions. So between the legs, behind the back, something like that. You can only get a gold medal. You must get a silver medal, which is an open shot in range and rhythm. We can talk about that in a little bit. There's a no space start. There's a start with space start. There's a change the angle start. In all these examples, I just want you to, I want to highlight, I am not coaching technique. I'm coaching decisions within the principles of play. So if there was something that I was going to ask the player or some type of explicit instruction I was going to give them, it's almost always relative to the decision they made and not the technique they applied. Okay, they got to the gold medal area and they didn't finish because they chose to do a 2-foot stop to a push shot and the defender was still chest to chest, meaning it's still a gold medal. It was a contested gold medal and they essentially shot a neutral shot without an open window. To me, okay, great. Can we do better? Again, it comes back to that. I wasn't wrong. We got a gold medal, yes, but can we do better? And that would be a way that I could ask some questions. If they repeatedly do that over time, I could say, okay, awesome job getting to the gold medal. And now, how can you create a bigger advantage? You already created a small advantage. So you see how we're referencing that as it's positive, but can it be better? And that's ultimately what coaching is. It's really, again, coaching is not telling people they're wrong. It's not telling them the problem and then sticking with it. It's like solution-based. It's, hey, okay, we're doing this. Now we can do it better. Here's how we can do it better. Make the comfortable uncomfortable and then make them uncomfortable again and follow this pattern where I make the comfortable uncomfortable and then make them comfortable again. And then I got to make them uncomfortable again. And that's ultimately it. So when I taught 3-on-1 transition to this new group of learners, high-level girls basketball players, in front of somewhat of an audience of coaches that are watching or administrators that are watching, there was some real discomfort, some serious discomfort from the players, from the people watching, because the players struggled. And a lot of players, and certainly a lot of high-level players at that point, were really accomplished players and had a lot of technique, were not used to being in situations where they struggled. And one girl phrased it for me really perfectly afterwards, and I think this is really relevant. This is really good feedback that I loved getting. And it was the fact that she said, for me, it wasn't about whether I liked it or not. I really did like it because it was more engaging and I played offense versus defense. But her main point was this, is that I'm used to doing drills where I know exactly what to do. And she connected that. And I thought that was really brilliant of her. And that in this drill, this 3-on-1 transition, or basically everything I did after that, which was all game-based offense versus defense, putting them in situations, that they really weren't used to it. And I had to defundamentalize them saying, hey, I understand you're used to doing this and this, A, B to C, because your coach has told you this. But in these examples, you can do C anytime you want. Our whole goal here is to take advantage of space. And within that advantage, leverage the advantage and score, or leverage that advantage and draw two defenders and pass. And that's as simple as it gets. And basically, everything I did with them for 2 days was based on those things. But it made them uncomfortable because they really did have to figure it out on their own rather than me putting them in a situation where, okay, we're just going to repeat this answer. Okay, just ride this stationary bike. Oh, and then I'll tell you that you're really good. No. Hey, let's get beyond this. And I really did say this to them. I said, listen, you're all outstanding. Your technique is tremendous. And now it's my goal to make you uncomfortable so that you can learn how to apply this technique in various ways to solve problems in the game. And it was beautiful to be able to watch in over 2 days the comfort level and the understanding that I can be just the best version of myself and take advantage of advantage as long as I understand my goal every time I catch the ball within an offensive zone is to score. And if I can't score, it's because a teammate has a bigger advantage or because I created an advantage by drawing two defenders and then I pass. And it's as simple as that. And that really did connect. This dribble moves culture, this culture of teaching dribble moves, man, I just can't say it enough because I'd say that's where the girls got the most advantage in this 3-on-1 transition was just learning to play in straight lines and not do dribble moves and not overpass the ball. Coaches have always told me, we got to pass, we got to pass, we got to pass. I'm like, hey, I'm telling you, you do not have to pass. And in fact, if you can score without a pass, that's more efficient and more effective. And there's pretty much any coach that would welcome that. We don't have to pass to score. We want to score. Passing is a secondary decision. Now, I understand passing can help us create advantages when the defense is neutral. I'm not saying that. But I'm saying with these space advantages, these angle advantages, attack in straight lines, change in counter, and then make a decision based on whether you draw the defender or you don't draw the defender. And then what happens when the defender takes away your decision, whether that's direction or space? To me, simple is sophisticated. Simple is sophisticated, right? I catch the ball. Defender's more than arm length away. I should be thinking shot. Whether I shoot it or not, that is determined by my technique, my confidence, but also is there a one more opportunity? Is there a bigger advantage for one of my teammates? But decision, simple is sophisticated. I catch it with space, I'm going to shoot. I catch it with no space, I'm going to drive or I'm going to pass the ball. Secondary decisions. When I drive the ball, I have a shoulder to chest advantage. I keep going. I drive the ball, and the defender takes away my shoulder to chest advantage by angling me away from the rim, two dribbles not towards the rim, or by cutting me off and getting chest to chest neutral. Then I have to counter or I have to pass. When do I actually pass? I pass if I'm taking two dribbles not towards the rim and I'm not going to counter. And that can be off a protection plan. Maybe I retreat dribble first or side dribble first to bounce to space to be able to move it. Or I stop, pivot, and pass. Sure. But the other thing is off that is that when I do attack, if I draw two, I pass. And that's really it. For every player individually and connecting to the team concept, we share those things. And I share those things everywhere this summer with players from all around the world at different levels of basketball. And it all affords them the opportunity to be able to hopefully, again, be the best version of themselves. That you don't need 100 moves to be a great basketball player. You need to understand how to take advantage of space and take advantage of angles. And we need to teach that more. We really do need to teach that more. We need to teach that more in guided and live, and we need to teach that more within small-sided games. And coming back to small-sided games, I know this is why I said it's a brain dump. I understand. But for me, it's just an opportunity to be able to share a whole bunch of ideas with you that have been stuck in my mind through these different conversations that I've been having all summer with different types of coaches. And it's been just beautiful. Again, just trying to add value. So when I think about a small-sided game now, this has been reflected in a lot of these conversations this summer. I now think about small-sided games as a series of interconnected games. So if you think about it, if you play a one-on-one with your players as a trainer or as a coach in a team context, that one-on-one should be a dynamic start to a game situation within small-sided game or within 5-on-5, 3-on-3. To me, also, 3-on-3, 4-on-4, 2-on-2 are interconnected to the game. So they should connect to the game. And again, come back to that teaching, connect, transfer. We're all so very good. Man, coaches are so very good at teaching what to teach, all good. Very rarely will I go to a coach and say, hey, have you thought about what you're teaching here? No, what you're teaching is awesome. But it's really the problem and the challenge is how do you connect it for a player and how do you get them to understand how to transfer it to the game? Is that this perceptual information, this decision-making process that they go through in practice or in these drills has to be the same as what they do in a game, and then it's more likely to transfer. So to me, this 3-on-1 transition example, player gets a ball, player's running the wing to the race read area. We pass them the ball, they catch the ball in space with a recovering defender. How to attack that space is a key fundamental of everything that we do. I within the two-sided fast break, it's probably the foundational thing to be able to drive the 45 and be able to again score, draw two. Mainly it's draw two and keep the ball moving, keep the dominoes falling. But to me, that is a interconnected concept that I need to create, not just a one-on-one, but I need to create a small-sided game to be able to explore that. So to me, the game informs me what the drills are that I'll use. And because we value that drive to 45 and that hit ahead, whether it's ball side or more likely early and opposite to the other side, then we want to play a lot out of that catch-in space where someone other than, say, a primary ball handler who dominates the ball, every player gets to explore possibilities to be able to attack in space and create advantages. So I need to create a one-on-one for that, which I do. Pass ahead one-on-one is on YouTube. It's one of the, again, platform drills that we do. And then from there, that one-on-one, if you see this dynamic start to it, that can be a dynamic start to 3-on-3. It can be a dynamic start to 5-on-5. So we'll literally play 5-on-5 out of that situation as a situational start, simply because we'll say, hey, we're playing pass ahead one-on-one to 5-on-5. So that's what I mean by interconnecting. All your small-sided games, all your games in practice, all your one-on-ones, all your technique development, all should be interconnected. Meaning this, I can actually see it happening here. And that's again coming back to the example of three-man weave. I don't ever see it happening in a game situation, and it doesn't help us ever create a space advantage or to take advantage of an angle advantage because again, the defender is just going to bust it up because we can't run that pattern versus an active defender. So don't do it. Just don't do it. The goal for all training and all practice for me, the goal is adaptability. So routines, like the routine of doing the same thing every day. Look, I'm not anti-routines, but it's not for me. It's not for me. And coaches have your players do the same routine every day. That's fine. But keep in mind, and this is again all back to evidence-based research, not just me, but a lot of it experiential as well, is routines build repeatability, but not reliability. Routines build repeatability, but not reliability. So the key to me for consistent performance isn't repetition, it's adaptability. So what happens when conditions change? What happens for the ability to the player to be able to adjust to ensure that they can still complete the task? So for everything that I do, whether it's with my daughters in their individual training, where we use constraint-based one-on-one workouts or guided-based one-on-one workouts, everything is to create adaptability, not repeatability. Like, honestly, I never have once talked to my daughters about using the same footwork on every shot. I literally don't want them to ever use the same footwork. Now, I don't tell them that explicitly, but the tasks demand that they have to use different types of footwork. Because, again, for me, it's adaptability. And I get the whole old school argument that, oh, you got to repeat the same thing over and over again and be able to replicate it exactly the way it is. But the reality is you don't ever replicate anything exactly the way it is because again the environment's novel, it's ever changing, and the situational task that is presented by the game and by a defender and by my teammates is always going to be different. So there is value to being able to try and repeat things within a adaptable environment, but I don't feel there's as much value as we think in trying to do repeatable things within a repeatable environment. And that's really all I'm getting you to think about is instead of going to a practice, I just shared this on my Instagram at Coach B-Ball Immersion. If you don't follow, but I share a lot more examples at Coach B-Ball Immersion on Instagram. I share a lot more examples of kind of the individual training I do with my different daughters. And but the one I just shared is her doing different types of traditional, what we call form shooting technique. And by the way, this is one of the, I've had players after I share this at camps and different things like that, especially the older players, come up to me and say how much they value this is just understanding a few logical things about form shooting and about these form reps. And again, I get it. Like people keep sharing, oh, an NBA player does it, so it's good enough for me. I had a coach the other day tell me Duke does on air in practice, so it's good enough for us. And I'm like, that's not really the way that I would approach anything in life. Is it's good enough for someone else? It's good enough for me. I want things that are the best for me. And just because Duke or someone else does on-air practice, it just might mean that they haven't considered any other possibilities. They haven't considered a better way. And this isn't anti-them or anti-anyone, but a lot of people are doing the same things because of survivorship bias and not because they feel it's the best way. They just haven't taken time to consider other ways. And that's all we're getting you to stimulate here is this concept of that. So this shooting example I just posted on Instagram of my daughter was basically her mixing. So let's say she did a roll up to a shot, she did a 1 foot stand to a shot, she did a wide feet to a shot, and then she just bounces to a shot. What I was showing is that she does these. First of all, she does them from about 12 feet, sometimes farther, sometimes closer, but never right at the rim. And I showed players this all throughout the summer, and their minds were blown by this. But go to the rim and do a traditional form shot. Where does your neck? Where's your neck? Your neck's looking back and up. And it's a totally unrepresentative feeling. And most importantly, it doesn't feel good. And everything to do with shooting comes back to this question. I ask players all the time, how does it feel? I am not here to tell you how to shoot. I am here to help shape your shooting within the law of biological individuality. The law of biological individuality. That's how does it feel for you? It's not how does it feel for me? And I don't want to come in with these biases. Your shot should look like this. No, how does your shot feel for you? And I'll share more about that. I'm going to post a thread here coming up in the next week or so on teaching shooting to new learners, and hopefully it'll help frame some of this. But the law of biological individuality basically says the concept of a biological entity from cells to organisms or whatever and beyond, that they all possess this unique characteristic that define them as individuals. So the concept's not strict. Of course, there's a lot of similarities, a lot of commonalities if you want to think about shooting. A tremendous amount of commonalities. Shooters generally bend and extend. They work in this kinetic chain from largest muscles to smallest muscles when they shoot. Shooters follow through. You can simplify it like that if you want to think about these different things that are all in common. But how they look and how they get there is often very different. How they lift the ball, how they extend, how they hold the ball. There's definitely these biological individualities that exist within shooting. And that's what I want to account for, not just in shooting, but all my teaching for players, is that they're not going to do things exactly the same way and that they're going to work differently. So the concept of law of biological individuality is not strict. It's universally accepted law, but rather it's more of a framework for understanding how someone would organize and how they would function in their environment. So they would all be different. If I drop my wife in the middle of a forest and say, hey, find your way out. And I drop myself in the middle of a forest and find my way out. There's going to be some commonalities to it, but we're going to definitely do things and approach things probably differently. Maybe that's an extreme example. Certainly learning to ride a bike. Both of my daughters learned to ride the bike completely differently. One was fast, one was slow, one was a little tentative, one was braver. There's differences because they're different human beings. They function differently in their environments. Back to the shooting concept, why am I saying that? Because these drills that she does basically, again, reflect things that she needs. So I'm not saying go replicate these drills and do these exact drills. I'm saying these help her feel better about her shot, comfort and confidence a little bit. But we do them in mixed ways. So literally, she'll never shoot the same one over and over again. So she'll do a roll up, and then she'll do a bounce, and then she'll do 1 foot, and then she'll do maybe a roll up again, and then she'll do wide feet. And I want it to be random. I want it to be not this routine, not this repeatable thing over and over again. I want her to be adaptable, not repeatable. So literally we have her just mix them all. Yeah, you can do any of these four. So sometimes we create the criteria, or sometimes they'll say, hey, go do some shots around 12 feet and she can do whatever one she wants and figures it out on her own. But the point is that I want her to be able to, each time she goes back to one of these, I want to stimulate retrieval practice, which leads to retention. So to me, it's okay, what did I do previously with wide feet? I'm doing it again, but in the middle, I have the spaced repetitions because in the middle, I have these other shooting activities that I did. That to me is one of the most important things that I've learned from training my oldest daughter in these one-on-one workouts is how to represent the environment better in these ways that it's like one mixing things. So you're never doing the same thing, repeating over and over again. Now I can task simplify and repeat. Okay, let's just focus on these two shooting exercises. But almost always, we usually have three or four that will mix because it's more game-like. Also, spaced repetitions doesn't have to mean she does a repetition in between. Literally, you'll do this where I will pass to her, say she's at the three-point line, she'll shoot, and then I'll hold the ball, I'll dribble, I'll mess around, I'll ignore her, sometimes I'll talk to her, and then I'll pass her the ball. Or I'll have her do something in between, which might be again, simple one would be, say, jog to half court, jog back, move around the 3-point line, cut, relocate, and then she doesn't know when she's going to get the ball. She's going to get the ball. To me, that's more representative of the game. And we don't do those all the time because sometimes we want to get a mass number of adaptable reps. But sometimes, literally, I just want her to get some more representative spaced reps. So we'll just hold the ball and not pass to her right away. So she doesn't do these repeat, repeat, memorize, regurgitate type of reps. She literally has to be present, she has to be ready, and then she has to be able to execute her technique in the context of a game, which means that she's not going to shoot over and over again in a game. She's going to shoot in spaced repetitions. So we're trying to simulate that. The law of biological individuality applies very much to constraints led to, and I just want to share this, but this concept of, I shared some stuff on defensive rebounding, constraint led approach to defensive rebounding in one of my threads on Twitter at B-Ball Immersion. If you don't follow those, you can just go advanced Twitter search, type in thread under the topic idea, and then go down in which ones to search and search at B-Ball Immersion, and all my different threads will come up. Very cool if you don't know that, but use advanced Twitter search and it'll help you find all the threads on basketball immersion. But you can read the one that's basically, again, about defensive constraint-led approach to defensive rebounding. But here's an example of law of biological individuality applied to a constraint-led approach. And this is the concept of an assist. And I had this asked by a G League assistant coach this year. Asked me, how can he use a constraint to be able to develop a player's ability to be able to pass the ball more? Meaning this player had incredible technique, they're individually really talented, but clearly they would shoot versus two instead of kick. And I saw that. If I would say one characteristic of all EYBL basketball I've seen is, and one thing that coaches could do immediately to improve their players and their team, is to have players be able to make early high paint decisions off the drive rather than taking that one more dribble and literally drawing two, but drawing two at a point where you're trapped, as opposed to drawing two at a point where there's space to be able to make a decision and space to be able to take advantage of advantage. But that type of thing is obviously paramount. So this G League coach assistant asked me, okay, how can I help this player develop within a constraint-led approach from an individual perspective? And I said, one thing is obviously to add more value for their assist. So anytime they get an assist in a practice game, that they get a plus one. So their team gets an extra assist. The problem with that is obviously now a player is just hunting passes instead of clearly playing the game and making decisions based on the game rather than the constraint. And that is a problem with the constraint-led approach, that you cannot keep the same constraints all the time because a player will learn how to manipulate that constraint and take advantage of the scoring rather than actually play basketball. So we do want them to score and we want them to draw two and we want them to pass. Another idea was to play around, and Coach tried both these and they said they were really good because they created an emphasis. And that ultimately is it. We're affording the opportunity for the player to be able to shape the things that we want to shape within the context of the game. So these constraints afford him the opportunity to be able to work on these different things. So the main one, the second one we tried was this assist king concept, that every assist from this player is worth 2 points. So encourage the behavior you want to see. Now, only a certain player was the assist king. So the idea of now we weren't isolating this player, we were creating a game situation where there's an assist king on both teams. And we could change that assist king. But that assist king within the context of the game, if they got an assist for their team, then the team got 2 points. So much similar to the first one, but just in a more variable way, is that we don't make it just one player all the time. We constantly change the assist king. And that could be as simple as an assistant coach from the sideline saying, Bill's the assist king, Bill's the assist king, and then changing it now, Donovan's the assist king, right? Whatever it may be. So those different things. Okay, shifting gears just a little bit as I wrap up, I was really taken aback. I never know sometimes what's going to hit on social media and what's going to connect with people and not. But this one did for whatever reason. It was just me in clinic, and I posted on all the platforms, but I think most of the feedback interaction happened on Instagram and TikTok. But the main thing was that I shared this video where I'm talking in clinic in Australia about parents and coaches taking away decisions for players in game situations, meaning a player or a coach is on the sidelines and they're shouting, pass the ball, shoot the ball, drive, drive, whatever it may be. But there's some type of guidance that is happening in the context of the game. And my argument is basically that I would rather have parents be quiet, and I would rather be quiet as a coach in a game so that it affords the opportunities for a player to be able to explore, meaning that they get to make a decision without being told what the decision is. Especially this connects for me because that's how we're trying to practice. So we're trying to reflect practice in games and make them as similar as possible. But even if you are more of a drill-based coach and you tell them what to do within the drills, they suddenly go into game situations and you're telling them, okay, now shoot, pass, pass, drive. You're actually taking away their opportunity to be able to perceive, decide, and execute because you've told them what to do. And we're actually taking away learning reps from them. And to me, this holds players back in their development, especially at the youth level when parents are shouting this from the sideline. Because what is a player going to do? They're ultimately going to try and praise their parent. Now, there are a lot of negative comments coming back, which is cool. I was grateful for that. A lot of people challenging it and a lot of people discounting it. And that's cool. I'm always happy for all those conversations, to be honest. But there's a myriad of reasons why constant instruction is not beneficial to development. But let's focus on just this one thing. You're stealing learning reps. Instead of players making their own decisions, your player is simply reacting to you as a parent or you as a coach. So they are losing the chance to develop their basketball IQ. And if foundationally there's one thing that I've traveled the world and every single coach or every single parent seems to want to improve for their player, is their basketball IQ. And yet we do these things that to me take away basketball IQ. When you are telling a player what to do, exactly what to do, you are taking away their opportunity to develop their basketball IQ. When you are having them ride a stationary bike and then putting them on a bike, biking to work and back, those are completely different contexts. And you are taking away their ability to learn in the environment in which they have to perform if you aren't putting them in the performance representative environment in practice. And those to me are the foundational things that come back to everything that I share within basketball immersion for the last 11 years is just let's coach kids more in the context of the game, represent the game more in your practice and your training, and give them space within your environment to be able to explore possibilities without being told explicitly what to do. I hope this whole podcast added value for you. I look forward to having many conversations with you about this. One of the things I'm supremely grateful for is how many of you DM, email, reach out, communicate in person when we're together, text, whatever, and ask questions. To me, again, I love the people that just challenge it and discount it. Sure, I'm here for that. That's absolutely a safe space. Hopefully that I've created in the environment that I'm sharing with for people to 100% disagree. But what I really value is the people that are open-minded, the people that think about, okay, let me consider this. Not that you're going to do it. That's not what I'm saying. You don't have to be complicit to be aligned. You just have to be open-minded in your spirit to be able to connect with what we're trying to share here, which is to constantly think, is there a better way? And I do feel there's a better way. Of course, I do. But at the end of the day, I want you to engage with this information. So if there's something from this podcast that connected with you, by all means, share it. If there's something with this podcast that you want to build on, then by all means, ask a question online, on Twitter, on social media, wherever. And then if there's something that you totally disagree with, I'd love to hear that too. I'd love for you to share more, and we can all increase the collective consciousness, especially coming from these brain dumps that I share with you. We can increase our collective consciousness of coaching and teaching and how to do better for our players and for our teams by sharing more of what you take away from this from an agree standpoint, from a build-on standpoint, or from a challenge standpoint. So I encourage you, please consider agreeing, building, or challenging on something that I shared here and share it with me in my DMs or share it with me on social media, which would be even better because that would generate more of a conversation for all of us. Thank you again for supporting the basketball podcast. Thank you for supporting Basketball Immersion. If you are not yet a member of Basketball Immersion, I really encourage you to DM me. I've got a special promo code for you. I just need more people to get in the environment that we've created to be able to stimulate your thinking and for me to be able to share more actively with you so that we can improve player development and coach development within the space that we've all created, which is such a beautiful space for being able to coach basketball to young people. Thank you so much and enjoy share the game.